From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and hola, Robin. We are broadcasting here and now today from KJZZ's Fronteras Desk Bureau in Mexico City at the Tech de Monterrey. We have been here for several days talking with people about news and politics and arts and culture, and we're going to be bringing those stories over the next couple of days.
Looking forward to that, Jeremy. But meanwhile, here in the States today, President Trump has been tweeting up a storm after that judge's decision yesterday blocking his order to withhold funding from so-called sanctuary cities, cities that don't fully cooperate with federal immigration or ICE officials. Trump tweeted, "See you in the Supreme Court." But Austin, Texas Mayor Steve Adler says Attorney General Jeff Sessions assured him in a meeting yesterday Austin would not be considered a sanctuary city, even though Austin is doing what most sanctuary cities do, and his state governor, Greg Abbott, has already cut some funds because of it. So Mayor Adler joins us now. And Mayor Adler, at the heart of this is the way federal ICE officials ask local police to detain people they've arrested for other crimes, so ICE officials can come and get them. One is a detention request with a warrant. The other is a warrantless civil request to hold on to people beyond their jail time. And you say, by law, that is voluntary.
It is amazing to me that there are so many people in the country that somehow or another believe that compliance with that voluntary civil detainer request is somehow mandatory or required by law. Not only did Attorney General Sessions tell me and several other mayors that that was not a violation of law yesterday when we met with him, but it's consistent with the documents that were filed last Friday when they identified some cities or counties that they thought could be sanctionable sanctuary cities. It's real clear that they are repeatedly saying that civil immigration detainers are voluntary requests, and because they're voluntary, they are not enforceable against the jurisdictions that don't comply.
And so to be very clear, Mr. Mayor, the first kind of detainer request, the one that's accompanied by a warrant, you have said we might consider honoring those.
Absolutely. They're being honored today. They have always been honored.
Because they come with a warrant.
They come with a law. Warrant. That's the law.
Yeah. Look, there seems to be a lot of misunderstanding here. When we heard the talking heads, the chattering class, discuss the judge's ruling last night, a lot of people said this meant that in sanctuary cities, federal officials couldn't do any work. Is that true? Are you banning, federal officials from coming and doing work with undocumented immigrants in Austin?
Absolutely not. The federal immigration folks have a job to do, and we wouldn't do anything to interfere or impede with their performance of their job and their duties. But what I will tell you is that our local police don't have the resources to be able to spend their time operating as federal immigration agents any more than they have the ability or the resources to operate as game wardens or federal tax agents or federal anything agents. And beyond that, what we are told by our local law enforcement professionals is that one of the reasons that Austin is one of the safest communities in the country is because of the trust relationship that exists between our law enforcement personnel and people throughout the community. The day when these folks are scared to go to police, you then have people that are perpetrating injury on them and feel like they can do it with impunity because they know they're not going to be turned in.
Do you at all worry, as the governor seems to, that you might be releasing violent and dangerous undocumented immigrants back into your community if you don't abide by that voluntary request from ICE officials to hold on to somebody until they can get there?
Whether or not someone is released to the streets isn't a decision that's made by the sheriff. It's made by the court. It's made by our judicial system. We have a system of bail in this country where if you go before a judge, you're accused of a crime. If you post bail, you get released. We're not treating undocumented people any differently than documented people.
Well, we also understand that one of your state reps there started a crowdfunding page, a Travis County Stronger Together hashtag, to raise money to offset the money that it was thought would be lost if the federal government cut funds. You haven't lost any federal money yet. With this judge's order, are you a little bit relieved?
It sure does make you proud to be in a community that actually starts a crowdfunding campaign like that, and I am. But we're concerned about the loss of state funding. I was reassured by the comments from Attorney General Sessions yesterday that the practices that we're following here in the city are not among the practices that he identified that would cause someone to lose federal funding. So that was good news.
That's Austin, Texas Mayor Steve Adler. Mayor Adler, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm broadcasting right now from Mexico City, and we'll be hearing today and tomorrow from many Mexicans about the relationship with the United States and much more. But to start our trip, we asked NPR's correspondent here, Carrie Kahn, to take us somewhere that would teach us something about Mexico. And she chose Ecatepec, and specifically a traffic-clogged hillside slum of some 2 million people outside Mexico City. It has a new transportation option that feels luxurious, even by U.S. standards. It's a gondola that flies over the slums, and we took a ride.
If you look out in front of us, it's just hillsides full of concrete houses all the way up the hill, all the way down. There was no infrastructure here for these people to get down from the bottom of the hill. So they built these gondolas. And usually when you're in a gondola with an amazing view, you're headed to the ski slopes.
Right.
But we are in the midst of one of the largest slums in Mexico City, heading to the top of the mountain here.
So is the primary goal here about transportation and getting people to and from work more easily?
Exactly. I've talked to people that now have this option to take this public transportation, and they tell you that before, if they lived, depending on how far up the hill they lived, it would take them 40 minutes to an hour just to get to the bottom of the hill, where then they have to get into a crammed van or little bus that then takes them another hour to the public transportation system of the city of Mexico. So just to get into the public transportation system of Mexico, it would take them an hour and a half. This now takes them 20 minutes.
Well, and another part of this is about crime, right? A lot of the people who traveled on the buses were getting robbed every day.
This is one of the highest crime areas in Mexico, the state of Mexico. It has an incredible homicide rate, kidnapping, extortion, and robbery. And you talk to people that are riding this transportation system right now, you just talk to anybody, and they have been robbed on that private little van transportation network. It was just terrible, and they're so thankful for this.
And as you were talking there, we're hearing some roosters in the background.
You can hear everything in this. This is such a compact slum. You can hear roosters. You can see people in their backyards hanging their laundry. We're looking down onto people's homes, walking. The streets are very narrow on these cinder block homes going up the hillside. I hear roosters. I hear dogs. You can hear the garbage collector. He rings a bell. You hear him. You can hear that in the distance. You can hear everything. And then what you will soon hear in just a moment is we're going to cross over the major highway that gets you out of Mexico City to the northern states. And this crosses right over it. That was also very problematic because the slum is cut in half by that major highway. And for people to cross it, there was no infrastructure. There's no roads. There's no tunnels. And this goes right over the highway and you'll hear it.
A few stops into our ride, we're joined on board by a family of three, a mother, Maury Set, and her two children, including 23-year-old Danielle, who told us he was robbed when he used to take ground transportation.
Me quitaron mis cosas, todas mis pertenencias, hasta los tenis.
They took everything from him, even his tennis shoes. ¿Y cómo se siente aquí?
Es un poco más seguro, sí.
A little safer, he says. I asked Carrie Kahn why she brought us here, what she thought this gondola ride over the slums symbolized about Mexico.
I brought you to the state of Mexico for a couple reasons. One, because what is happening now in Mexico is an incredible crime wave, and Mexico, the state of Mexico, is experiencing that in huge numbers right now. In the first 3 months of this year, there's been more than 2,000 homicides throughout the country. There hasn't been that many homicides in a month of March since 2011. What's happening now in Mexico is crime rates that are rivaling at the height of the drug war in 2011. So I wanted to bring you to Mexico State so that you could understand the poverty and the crime and the violence that is going on. I also wanted to bring you to this to see just some of the problems that are occurring in Mexico right now, infrastructure. And this is no better example, these tiny little roads, concentrated slums and housing and no public transportation. And this gives you a bird's-eye view that not very many get to see.
And now we are going over the highway that you mentioned.
yeah, you can, you'll hear the traffic, the huge cargo trucks that are going through. It is an 8-lane highway that we're going over right now, and you can hear it. And then if you look to your right or your left, there are no bridges that cars can travel over. So what it did was it cut the slum in half, 1 million on one side and 1 million on the other, with very few transportation options to get out. So it was just a public transportation nightmare.
Carrie says officials here are looking at the success of this gondola and considering more, but at 6 pesos a ticket, or about 30 cents, projects like this are not self-sufficient and will require significant government investment. You can see photos of the new Mexicable gondola over the slums of Ecatepec at hereandnow.org. It's Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from Mexico City, where despite President Trump's tweets and statements about Mexico, there are still lines of people every day applying for visas to come to the U.S. outside the U.S. Embassy.
Valentina Ana Maria.
And why do you want to go to the United States?
Quiero ir a conocer.
She wants to go and visit, know the country, and visit relatives she has there.
Edilberto Ríos Juárez.
And why do you want to go to the United States?
Queremos visitar.
So I would like to go because I want to know places. I love history. I'm a fan of history. Also, I have a relative there. My brother is a citizen, and I would like to go and visit him.
Sheila Cristel.
And why do you want to go to the United States?
Porque quiero conocer.
I want to know your country and your culture, and I want to have some challenges in my life.
And how difficult is the process of getting to the U.S.?
Pues creo que sí es difícil.
I wanted to do things legally, like in the right way, and come here and ask for a visa, but they just don't accept it, and that's why people go there illegally, and they don't welcome us as we do. We welcome them, and they discriminate us, and I mean, we are humans, and we just go there and want to know their country, and that's all we want to do.
That's a sentiment we've heard a lot in Mexico City. What did we do to you? Senator Armando Rios Peter is taking that a step further and proposing a boycott of U.S. corn in response to President Trump's statements about Mexico. He's attempting to mount an independent bid for the presidency in Mexico's election next year. I asked him to respond to President Trump's tweet from a few days ago, which read, quote, "Eventually, but at a later date so we can get started early, Mexico will be paying in some form for the badly needed border wall."
Well, I don't understand Mr. Trump. I think he might be bipolar. He might be schizophrenic. I mean, he sends these kind of tweets, but before his Minister of the Interior, his Minister of Homeland Security was saying that Mexico was being so much help to the U.S. regarding security. So I don't understand who should I believe. Of course, I should hear President Trump first of all, but his signals, the way he's doing, the way he's thinking, the relationship with my country, I think it's a very changing one. So this gives us a signal that he doesn't know what to do with Mexico.
Do you see any scenario in which Mexico pays for the border wall?
Of course, that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard. I mean, that's the way I've seen it every time. And I think President Peña Nieto has made a big mistake not saying in their very first moment, not only that it was stupid to allow President Trump that we will pay for it, but we must be calling the wall in its terms. It's a hostile act. It's an unfriendly act. I mean, and Mexico should be saying it in all the cardinal points in all the world. We should be saying it in the United Nations. We should be saying it in the OAS. We should be telling every country that the United States is being hostile and unfriendly to Mexico and that the world represents that.
It's been talked about that there are ways that Trump could get Mexico to pay, including increasing visa fees, adding tolls on bridges across the border.
Well, of course, he has the capacity to do that. He has the capacity to increase what we pay for going to the United States, but that will also cost a lot to the United States. We, as Mexicans, spend a lot in tourism If that changes, of course, that will also cost a lot to a lot of Americans, to people in Florida, to people in California, to people in New York. We Mexicans love to go there. But, of course, if he increases visas, we'll stop going there.
How would you describe the state of U.S.-Mexico relations right now?
Well, it has been for the last two decades a very important, strong one, not only in terms of trade, but also in terms of helping each other regarding security. Also, in terms of migration, doing labor, I think that's part of our common prosperity. So I like to think U.S.-Mexico relationship as one that should continue in good terms. But unfortunately, we have now this president who doesn't understand how important is my country. And me as a senator and some other Mexicans need to stand up. That's what I've been trying to do.
Well, you have suggested boycotting U.S. corn.
Yes, of course. Those who support Donald Trump's speech are the ones in the Midwest, the ones who support the most his speech. And when I sent this bill into the Senate saying we won't buy any more corn to Iowa, to Nebraska, to Wisconsin, to North Dakota, South Dakota, then they said, what's going on? Why is this senator saying this? Well, we are spending like $1,600 million a year regarding corn. So this means a lot of money for the pocket of farmers in the Midwest, for producers in the Midwest. And
but wouldn't it be more expensive if you were to buy it from somewhere else?
No. Surprisingly, it is even cheaper if we buy it to Brazil, and especially if the United States is having a hostile position against us, is a good way to tell them we won't continue collaborating. Probably we won't collaborate buying corn, and we won't probably collaborate in terms of anti-terrorism. I mean, why should we be doing it with a hostile administration and the one that Donald Trump is leading?
Well, you've gone as far as to say that Mexico should take back the land that was given in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, which includes California and a lot of Western states.
It's a very big territory, the one that was taken from us in that war. So what I said is that Mexico should be analyzing every treaty we have with the United States. The thing is, why should we continue collaborating with the United States, with this administration especially, if this administration is saying that Mexico is not a friend, that Mexico is kind of an enemy, that Mexico is taking advantage regarding trade? I mean, the thing that we should be doing right now is saying very clear messages to Donald Trump's administration. Mexico is a good partner. Mexico has been a very good friend. And Mexico does a lot of things for Americans to have security. If they want us to continue doing that, then they must treat us as friends.
Do you have any sympathy for the Americans who voted for Donald Trump, who believe that jobs are going to Mexico and that a lot of Mexicans are coming into the U.S. without proper documentation and costing them jobs?
Well, they have a point. No? I mean, I know that they feel uncomfortable for having people who they call illegal aliens, not having papers. But the way to deal with this, there's two ways to deal with this. Attacking their human rights, attacking their civil rights. I mean, not recognizing that they've been good people who have paid taxes, who are very important for the development of a lot of communities in the U.S. I mean, if you recognize that, then we must deal with the issue as a common problem. I mean, in between partners, you can have problems and you can deal with them as a shared problem and trying to build a common solution, or doing what Donald Trump has been doing right now. We are going to take care of this situation. We are going to build a wall. And then that's two parts who are separated. In that way, then Mexico must deal with the issue in a different way than collaborating.
The other day, we saw the beautiful Diego Rivera mural, which is sort of a short history of Mexico. And our guide was saying, Mexico has never been as rich as it was. What do you see as the economic future of Mexico? Can it get back to its golden era?
Well, of course. I mean, Mexico will be a very rich country, a serious global player, probably the fifth most important economy in the whole world in the next 25 years. And this view has to do with the relationship we have with the United States. And that's also in the interest of the United States. We together have a, we'll have a probably 500 million people together. I mean, that's a huge, a very powerful muscle. The distance in between the minimum wage in the United States and Mexican minimum wage is 14 times. So, of course, that's a reason people are going to the United States. And that's a reason some Americans are feeling afraid of losing their jobs. They're feeling afraid of knowing people from of brown color. I mean, there's a lot of fear regarding what's happening right now. That's why the speech and the position of Donald Trump is so bad.
Do you think you'd be able to work with President Trump if you become the president of Mexico?
Well, I must be able to do that, of course. But I think the issue with Americans, with people from the United States and any part of the world is talking straight. But if you put with dignity and in a very clear way your position, then that's a good way to talk. And that's the way we've been dealing with the United States, not only for 20 years, but for two centuries. So that's the way I would be working with Donald Trump or with Pence or with any people from the U.S. I studied in Harvard. I studied in Georgetown. I mean, I have a very good friends who are Americans. I love Americans. I like dealing with them. I like talking with them. I like laughing with them. But dignity is the kickstart for any kind of relationship. And that's the kind of relationship I want to make very clear for my country.
Senator Armando Rios-Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you very much.
And we've got more from Mexico City at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first three meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
Many prison programs work with inmates on writing skills to give them a way to express themselves and develop those skills. But now a program in Miami has teamed up with a month-long poetry festival to try and publish prisoner poems in an unusual way. Wilson Serif, Here Now contributor WLRN, explains.
Miami inmates are what becomes of the chicken before I fry it up.
Miami inmates are a device used to tell time.
Miami inmates are items of furniture for frightened people to lie down and rest upon.
Those are Miami inmates reading a few of the one-line poems written by South Florida prisoners. They're involved in a project called View Through, organized by the poetry festival O Miami and the writing class called Exchange for Change.
Miami inmates are sunbathing underwater. I have no idea what it means.
Eduardo Martinez is incarcerated at Dade Correctional Institution. He reluctantly calls himself a poet and tries to explain the meaning of his poem.
We're drowning in very, very murky waters, and we're trying to break through. We're trying to break the surface. At the same time, we're doing something under this water that a lot of people ain't seeing. You know, we're writing, we're succeeding, we're alive, we're surviving. We're not what you think we are.
He says street people, as they call the people on the outside, don't get what it's like to be on the inside. People often turn to Google to try and find out. When you type the phrase Miami inmates in Google, it offers suggestions on what to search for before you're even done. Miami inmate mugshots, Miami inmate court dates, and Miami inmate release.
And we saw that as a space where a lot of meaning is made before people even search.
Julia Weiss is a New York-based artist who uses the internet and crowd participation as her medium. She's trying to figure out a way to get poems to pop up along with these other search results and predictions.
And we thought if we could populate that area with poetry, there'd be a real opportunity there to inject a little bit of humanity into the search result space.
The algorithm Google uses to determine what shows up in the search predictions is a trade secret. But Weist has been playing around with trying to figure out how to manipulate that algorithm for a while. For one of her earlier projects, she found this word from the 1600s in an old book.
Parbuncles, P-A-R-B-U-N-K-E-L-L-S.
It's a kind of rope used by mariners.
And it had just never migrated to the 21st century. It had never been used online, even though it was an English language word used in print.
Like, if you Googled it, nothing came up. So Wiest made a website using the word and then displayed the word on a billboard in New York City.
It went viral. We saw use on five continents and multiple languages. Actually, within about 2 weeks, we saw 22,000 new search results.
So she's trying to do something similar with poems written by incarcerated people in South Florida. She and others are organizing people in Miami to Google six of the poems to try and start a Google trend.
And it would start to overtake the other language that was used for the prompt, Miami inmates.
The hope is that trend gets big enough that if you just type in Miami inmate, that auto-populate will work and bring up the poems. Here's Eduardo Martinez again, who can't Google anything himself because he's in prison.
We're trying to break the stereotype and change the algorithm.
He says he hopes it'll change how people think about inmates.
I'll write a line every day if I have to, you know it. Miami inmates are sunbathing underwater. Miami prisoners are, and I just keep going.
He says through his and others' poems, maybe someone will be willing to jump in the water with them. For Here and Now, I'm Wilson Sayre in Miami.
It's Here and Now, and I'm broadcasting from Mexico City today. And while we're here, we're going to do a special Mexican edition of the Here and Now DJ sessions. Rulo David Vasquez is a name known to many here, a longtime DJ and music critic who now hosts a podcast called La Edad Media, and he owns a restaurant. Rulo, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, I'm very happy to be here.
And by the way, what's the restaurant like?
Well, it's family recipes. It's very busy. A lot of mezcal, a lot of beers. It only opens at night. It's called Paramo, after the famous novel Pedro Paramo by Juan Rulfo, probably the biggest and the most important Mexican writer ever.
Well, it sounds good, but we are here to talk about music mostly. And first of all, for people from the United States, when they think about Mexican music, maybe they think about something like mariachi. Now, we're going to hear some new Mexican music, but is that still part of the musical scene in Mexico?
Well, there's a plaza called Garibaldi where you can pick up a mariachi and take it to play a serenade to the loved one. But no, young people don't listen to mariachi that much, at least not in Mexico City. Maybe in other parts of the country they do, but in Mexico City, not really.
Okay, so what's the music scene like here now?
Well, like if you go to clubs, there's a lot of techno music and there's a lot of rock music and there's hip hop. Those are the main things that people in Mexico City are listening, but countrywide, it's banda, what rules, what's most popular.
Okay, well, let's listen to some of the music that you wanted us to hear. This is a longtime band in Mexico. This is called Café Tacuba, and here is Futuro. Al final, ¿qué importa si muerto en vida sobrevivir? Now, this group has been around since the 90s. What more can you tell us about them?
Well, people say they are our Radiohead, and they have a large audience in the United States. And here in Mexico City, they can even play for 60,000 people. They're very popular, and it's very curious because they do really experimental music. They embrace alternative rock, electronic, whatever, and regional music, and they make a very natural mix of all these musics that doesn't feel forced.
All right, well, let's get to another big musician here. This is Natalia Lafourcade with Tú Si Sabes Quererme. Tú Si Sabes Quererme. Tú Si Sabes Adorarme, mi amor. No te vayas, quédate por siempre, para siempre, para siempre amarte. Corazón, tú sí sabes.
Flor encendida que da color al jardín de tu vida. Corazón.
So who is Natalia Lafourcade?
Well, we've known Natalia like 17 years ago. She started out when she was 16. She was a pop star, and she started doing this more personal music till arriving what you hear now, which is amazing because she's very popular. And if you turn on any FM commercial radio station, you will hear this music, this song in particular, next to Justin Bieber or reggaeton or whatever is mainstream right now. So she's doing something that nobody else is doing. And this record in particular, it's a new one called Divas. It's coming out in a couple of weeks also. She's doing songs by folk female singers from all Latin America. And she's like in her early 30s, and she's playing with musicians that are in their early 80s, which is very interesting.
Wow. And what is the mix on the radio between U.S. music and Mexican music?
Right now, it's more music in English than ever. Not only American, also British and Australian and Swedish. But yeah, the pop stations now play like 80% music in English, 20% music in Spanish, and reggaeton is huge.
All right, well, now to the band Little Jesus. This is called La Magia.
Yo sé que no vas a regresar, pero nadie se tiene que enterar de lo que pasa cuando faltas. Eso te pasa por hablar de
So how would you describe this one?
They are our Vampire Weekend, I would say. They're posh, educated guys. They do really smart lyrics. And they're quite new, and they became popular very fast.
Uh-huh.
And they're like one of the promises of indie rock in Mexico City.
And do you think there's a direct connection between indie rock in Mexico and indie rock in the United States?
Yeah, of course. I think sound-wise, there are a lot of coincidences. And I think bands in Mexico are listening a lot to what's happening in the United States and in England too, because we have been listening to British music a lot more than in the United States, you know. Like bands like Oasis, Blur, Pulp, the Britpop explosion was huge in Mexico, so that also had an influence on music.
How do musicians make it happen in this city? Do they have to get radio play, or does it start in clubs, or what happens?
They get played on public radio and college radio. Uh-huh. And it's very difficult for them to have some airtime on mainstream radio. And they start playing clubs. There's a lot of festivals in Mexico City, probably 5 or 6, which are very important for the up-and-coming bands. And yeah, their audiences start growing. And a band like Little Jesus, they do a lot of work online. So that helps them a lot.
Now, why do you think they call themselves Little Jesus and not Little Jesus?
I don't know. I think they were called Little Ethiopia in the beginning, after a neighborhood in L.A. And I don't know why or how it changed to Little Jesus. But I don't know, because, you know, bands here in Mexico, a lot of them sing in English and are part of this global culture. They travel a lot. They play in South by Southwest or in festivals in the U.S., you know?
Yeah.
So calling yourself Little Jesus makes it easier to transcend the wall.
All right, well, the last one that we have here from you is from the producer Zoot Zoot. This is called Mareo. So you're finishing up here with the dance clubs.
Yeah, that's very underground. That's very, very underground. Zoot Zoot is part of a collective label called NAFI. And they started doing parties, and then they started recording music. Then something very interesting happened, because they started having dialogues with similar collectives worldwide. And they have created this network of people that have the same interests as them. So they play all over the world, like in Korea or Japan or New York, San Francisco, wherever. And they bring musicians from other parts of the world to play in Mexico City, and they throw these amazing parties in warehouses and everything. Yeah.
Is electronic music big in Mexico right now?
Yeah, it's been big like since the 80s, you know. So it has never left. Like goth culture never left Mexico. Electronic music has never left Mexico since the 80s, you know.
Wow.
And it's still huge.
Well, Rulo David Vasquez, host of the podcast La Edad Media, talking with us about some new music coming out of Mexico during our trip here to Mexico City. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here and to introduce some of the musicians of our city.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. That's NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Sexual assaults on college campuses have made headlines, including last year at Baylor University. The school was found to have mishandled accusations of sexual assault perpetrated by former football players. Well, now Indiana University is taking a step forward in addressing sexual assault and sports. Earlier this month, the school's athletic director enacted a policy that bans any incoming freshman or transferred student athlete with a history of sexual abuse or domestic violence who's been convicted or pled no contest to a felony involving sexual violence. Fred Glass is the athletic director whose policy this is. He joins us now. Fred, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So we should say that some conferences have implemented bans or asked their schools to somehow implement a ban. I'm thinking of the Southeastern Conference. You're in the Big Ten. They did not tell you you had to do this. So why did you do this?
Well, I think it was important to do. I do think the SEC deserves a lot of credit for leading on this. They had the transfer ban, as you know. Their policy applies only to students transferring in. I thought this would be a policy that maybe the Big Ten would want to consider, but the Big Ten concluded that it should be addressed on an institution-by-institution basis. So we at Indiana concluded we did want to have such a policy. I think our policy is actually broader than that in the SEC in that it essentially disqualifies any student coming into the school if they have a documented history of sexual violence.
You know, my second thought on hearing this, my first was, oh, this is, you know, interesting and whether or not you had to do it and why you did it. But my second was, wow. Do you feel you have to protect yourself from that many students coming in who might have these terrible charges?
You know, I think probably the answer is no. But I think it's an important statement to make that we consider the acts of sexual violence so severe that we are essentially giving a student essentially the death penalty in terms of participating in intercollegiate athletics, which we think, one, helps protect the broader university community, and two, helps us to the greatest extent we can ensure that we don't have serious misconduct among our students, which, of course, is a challenge of young people of that age. But I think there are certain things we can do to lessen our risk in that regard.
Is that what it's about, protecting the students from somebody who might be predatory? Or is it, you know, because you feel responsible, you know, no school wants to get sued?
Well, I think it's sort of both of those things. As the statement says, the main reason for this policy is to protect all members of the Indiana University community. But a second part is, you know, we are ultimately responsible for the conduct of our students who participate in intercollegiate athletics.
Yeah. What if someone's been accused but not convicted?
Right. So that's a great question. So this policy basically has two components. One is mandatory, but there's also a discretionary provision that was already in place but is reflected in this policy that says, hey, even if you're not convicted, if you've been accused or involved in a very serious case of misconduct, or maybe you've had repetitive non-serious cases of misconduct, either criminal or in your school, then as a matter of discretion, we can and have refuse to extend athletic eligibility to those prospective students as well.
Well, your school is being sued by a former Indiana University student, now not a student athlete, Aaron Farrer, a 21-year-old who says the rape allegations against him were taken as truth from the outset and male students don't get due process. That nothing was true. Do you worry that, especially since it's sports, which it can often be the very thing that puts a young person on the right path if they've made a mistake, but maybe not the mistake they're accused of, you know. Do you worry that you might be depriving a young person of the thing that might save them?
Well, I'm responsible for about 700 students between the ages of 18 and 21, so I worry all the time about everything. But I particularly worry about just what you described, that there's two sides to every story and that these situations are often very, very complicated. And I think that's why if a court of law or a fully advised formal administrative panel has adjudged you to be guilty or responsible of these acts, then we're confident that's sufficient due process. Mm-hmm. That's why at Indiana, we rely 100% on our Office of Student Ethics. We don't do any investigations within athletics. You know, that's the great lesson from Baylor and other cases where I think they were described as a black hole that sucked in information within the athletic department. The first thing we do is get it outside the athletic department in the criminal justice system or administratively with our Office of Student Ethics, which is set up to strike the balance you describe between the accused and the accuser.
You mentioned you have an office of ethics there. You're doing internet searches.
Right. I mean, we expect our coaches to do a certain amount of due diligence when they are pursuing a young man or a woman. That includes an internet search, talking to counselors, teachers, families. There may be situations where they simply couldn't find that information out in a reasonable way, and we'll understand that. But if they should have found out and didn't or didn't want to, then there'll be repercussions on the coaches as well.
That's Fred Glass, athletic director at Indiana University. He's just instituted a new policy there, banning any incoming freshman or transfer student athlete with a conviction or no contest plea for sexual or domestic violence. Fred, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Jeremy Hobson is in Mexico. He'll continue reporting from there tomorrow. I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.